Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oh, it's easy to say it's just a number, but you don't really believe that, do you? It's one of those things analysts call a psychological barrier, like it's a big deal to hit it. The Dow stands above 13,000 today. Now, does it really matter? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers to bring about ideas for nourishing the world. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us today. It's April 25th, a Wednesday. 13,089.89 was the official close. The blue chips gained more than a percent to pop through the 13,000 barrier after a week or so of trying. It might be easier to ask, though, what wasn't up than what was. Both the NASDAQ and the S&P are on the rise. Ditto for the Russell 2000, the Wilshire 5000, you name it, it's going up. There are those who will tell you they're all signs the economy is officially up. Others say it's just a bunch of numbers. Marketplace's Elisa Roth tells us more now from New York.
It took more than 7 years for the Dow Jones Industrial Average to go from 11,000 to 12,000. Today's milestone came much faster. Only 129 trading days have passed since it hit the 12,000 mark last October. But analyst John Kozar of Asbury Research is unimpressed.
It's the bellwether, and it's the one that everybody likes to talk about around the water cooler. But I think it's probably more important to the sale of party hats at CNBC than it does as any kind of an economic indicator.
Kozar says it's unreasonable to judge the state of the economy or even the market by an index like the Dow Jones Industrials, which has only 30 companies in one sector. The NASDAQ and the broader S&P 500 are both up too, and some market watchers say that gives today's number more weight. But to use a cliche, what goes up must come down. And A.G. Edwards market strategist Al Goldman says it's not a question of if the correction comes, but how.
We can have a cardiac arrest where the market drops dramatically in a couple of days and it takes care of the excesses. Or we can get the old-fashioned water torture treatment that takes 2, 3, 4 weeks. And there's no way to know in advance which it's going to be.
Strong first quarter profit reports have helped push the market upward, but earnings season is almost over. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
As long as we're on the markets, let's do a little trivia quiz while we've got a minute here. An easy one to warm up. What's Google's ticker symbol? G-O-O-G would be the right answer. All right, now what about General Electric? Also an easy one, I should tell you. G-E. That's handy stuff to know if you're an investor. But for companies, ticker symbols carry a certain status, and they aren't just handed out willy-nilly. A symbol of 1 to 3 letters suggests the company is listed on the New York or American Stock Exchange. Companies on the newer NASDAQ, meanwhile, use 4 and 5 letter symbols. At least for now they do. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Last month, Delta Financial Corporation began trading its shares on the NASDAQ stock market. Company executives gathered in Times Square to ring the opening bell, which basically entails posing for pictures as an electronic soundtrack blares. What was unusual about this opening was Delta's ticker symbol, DFC. Those are the same 3 letters it had used previously to trade on the American Stock Exchange. NASDAQ CEO Bob Greifeld himself marked the occasion.
They are the very first company on the NASDAQ stock market in our 36-year history to use a 3-letter symbol. And we congratulate you for that.
But not everyone applauded NASDAQ's move. The New York and American stock exchanges have asked the SEC to ban NASDAQ from using shorter symbols. They argue that a change could confuse investors and create a symbol shortage. Ed Moore is general counsel at RPM International. It makes industrial coatings and sealants. The company trades as RPM on the New York Stock Exchange. Moore says those three letters convey an important association with the NYSE.
I mean, you can't deny it. I believe that it's still considered to be the largest market in the world, and I think it's been a real benefit to our shareholder base to have that.
But companies also hate to switch symbols if they change markets. They have to do marketing, investors don't know how to find them on the internet, and NASDAQ argues the current system unfairly protects the New York Stock Exchange's business by making it less convenient for companies to list elsewhere. James Angel teaches finance at Georgetown University. He says it's a dilemma familiar to consumers.
It's a lot like switching phone companies. If you can take your phone number with you, it's a lot easier to switch from one phone company to another because you don't have to tell all your friends you got a new phone number.
Angel says this battle over the alphabet is just another stage in a fierce struggle between NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange for trading volume and for listings.
A decade ago, it was unheard of to hear of companies moving from the New York Stock Exchange to NASDAQ, but we've seen companies actually doing that in the last few years.
That's partly because the SEC forced the New York Stock Exchange to abandon an old rule. It required companies to get shareholder approval before switching markets. Some companies prefer NASDAQ's all-electronic market to the NYSE's hybrid system, where people still execute a lot of the trades. Now NASDAQ wants to make it even easier for companies to switch. The SEC says it will settle the matter soon. Public comments were due today. As for Delta Financial Corporation, it gets to keep its three-letter ticker symbol, whichever way the SEC rules. Regulators approved the switch as a one-time deal. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
GE gained 1.8% today. Google up a tenth. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The financial action today was on Wall Street, but New York, both the city and the state, want more. More than 5 years after September 11th, they're still trying to lure businesses back to Lower Manhattan. J.P. Morgan Chase was supposed to be a big part of that recovery. The bank has made a tentative deal to build a 50-story tower right next to Ground Zero. But according to the New York Times today, Chase wants a bigger package of subsidies before it'll completely commit. Otherwise, it might swap the buzz of downtown Manhattan for the more subdued surroundings of Stamford, Connecticut. Ashley Multite reports.
Since 9/11, officials have offered tax breaks and other subsidies to firms willing to relocate downtown. J.P. Morgan Chase has already been offered $100 million in incentives, but the New York Times reports it wants more. Chase wouldn't comment for this story. Dan Steinberg is with Good Jobs New York.
The bottom line is that Chase's decision on where to locate is going to be based on what's best for business, not based on who wins this wasteful bidding war.
Still, if Chase is playing chicken, there's a reason. In 2005, Goldman Sachs landed a $650 million subsidy package for building downtown. Chase wants something similar. But Steinberg says that was then.
The mayor has made it very clear that that was an exceptional case. It was one of the first major decisions from a bank to move back downtown after September 11th.
He says that whopping amount was partly to make up to Goldman Sachs for mistakes that were made in planning the site. It's highly unlikely Chase will get anywhere near that much. So if the bank does flounce out of Manhattan and up to Stamford, Connecticut...
Well, it'd be a major coup, not just for the city, but for the state.
That's Mike Freemuth with Stamford's Office of Economic Development.
There's the income taxes, there's the corporate taxes, there's a variety of secondary impacts. We know, for instance, that just about every financial services job generates another 2.5 jobs in support services.
Still, the move is far from a done deal. Freemuth's not breaking out the champagne just yet. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Would it surprise you to know there's a very good chance your doctor is being wined and dined by the makers of the drugs you're being prescribed? We've known for years now that doctors have close relationships with drug makers. All those free samples they give out have to come from somewhere, after all. But according to a survey being published in tomorrow's New England Journal of Medicine, nearly all physicians report some type of relationship with the pharmaceutical industry. That's everything from free food and drink to having the drug industry pay for what's considered professional services. Here's Marketplace's Bob Moon.
What's a little bubbly between friends? It seems 4 out of 5 doctors recommend it, or specifically 83% report receiving some kind of food or drink from the pharmaceutical industry. Under the medical profession's self-imposed rules, such gifts are supposed to benefit patient care. Despite recent pressure to avoid conflicts of interest, 94% of practicing physicians report some type of relationship with the drug companies. Some have been reimbursed for continuing medical education. Others got paid for consulting. Some got free lunches or free samples aimed at promoting new drugs to patients. Harvard professor Eric Campbell is one of the study's authors.
I don't have any doubt that some forms of these relationships, like giving samples and providing lunch, has a positive influence on drug companies' ability to market their drugs and services, because if it didn't, they wouldn't do it.
The study didn't address what types of relationships are appropriate versus inappropriate. Campbell says that's a question doctors still need to answer.
I think it's really up to the profession to continue to struggle with, you know, which of these relationships are acceptable and which are not, based on the benefit that they provide to the patient.
Campbell also suggests that patients need to add their voice to the debate as well. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
It has contaminated pet food and livestock feed, and now the Food and Drug Administration is looking into whether melamine, that's a chemical usually found in plastics, might have found its way into the human food chain. It was originally mixed into wheat gluten and rice protein imported from China. We don't know exactly how bad it might be if melamine did get into the food supply, but the FDA is examining 6 grain products that are used in everything from bread to baby food. Harry Balzer is with the market research firm NPD Group. Mr. Balzer, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Just the fact that you and I are having this conversation today indicates that, at least in some measure, food supply and food safety is something we're going to talk about. But is it something that we take action on?
Typically, no. That's not to say there aren't portions of the population who will respond, but generally food safety is just something we talk about, not something we react to. And we've had a lot of these issues over the last 5 or 6 years, but we've never really seen a significant change long-term to the way we eat. We've seen short-term disruptions, but not long-term.
What about the short-term pain felt by some of the producers? I'm thinking now of spinach growers who lost a bunch of revenue during the E. coli scandal and quick food hamburger chains who lost some revenue.
And this is why we keep this food safe, is because it is a short-term disruption. It's very painful in the short run. But in the end, you'll find a supplier who will provide you with safe food, giving you the foods that you always wanted to eat to begin with.
Okay, so let's be opportunistic about this and figure out who might benefit. Do you think organics would see a bump because of this?
I don't think this is a bad thing for organics. Organics certainly have been growing. Right now, 21% of the U.S. population eats organic foods on a regular basis, and that means having something that's organic at least once every 2 weeks. And it's a big growing number. Every time we look at the number, it's higher than it was the quarter before. So this is a growing area. I think it will benefit. I also think locally grown will benefit from this, because I think this, what is happening right now, is something that's coming into the country, and there's probably questions about what's coming into the country and the safety of that food supply, so that I think locally grown might get a benefit from this.
Is there a price point analysis you can do here? How sensitive are consumers to the difference between something that might be imported and perhaps not as safe versus something that's local or organic and maybe a bit more expensive?
Well, safety is paramount. You have to have a safe food supply. That generally just causes short-term disruptions because we will not have an unsafe food supply. Even though it seems like it's unsafe or there's issues that arise, it's about 68% of the U.S. population believes that the food supply is safe. Now, that's not to imply the rest think it's unsafe. The rest just don't know. But that 68%, what interests me, is over the last 6 years, that number has not changed at all. Despite all the issues that we've had come, whether it's mad cow or E. coli or acrylamide or benzene or some issue that may have come in, the percent of the population that thinks the food supply is safe is almost unchanged. What changes are our issues. What's the thing that we're talking about today?
Well, what is the thing we're talking about today if it's not safety of the food chain? Is it globalization and its impact on how we eat? I mean, what's right at the tip of this debate?
Well, the truth of the matter, the driving force in our eating patterns are always two things. How easy is it to get that food? How easy is it to prepare? Convenience is a driving force, and it's only how we're going to define that. And what does it cost? In 60 years, we've never let food costs rise faster than our incomes. As a matter of fact, they've always declined. I don't think that's going to change. So when you move to things that are more expensive or more inconvenient, it's not something that's going with the trend.
Harry Balzer is vice president at the consumer marketing firm NPD Group in Chicago. Mr. Balzer, thanks a lot for your time.
You're more than welcome.
Coming up, in presidential politics, a dollar is a dollar is a dollar.
He actually did get some attention for having raised a lot of money, even though he was in the second tier of candidates. And I thought, well, you know, so my little teeny tiny contribution probably helped towards that.
But first, let's do the numbers. So here we are in 13,000 land. The Dow Industrials gained 135 points, 1% to close at 13,089. The NASDAQ climbed 23 points, almost 1%, closing at 2547. The S&P 500 up 15 points, that's about 1%, to close at 1495. The Dow wasn't the only number that was cause for celebration today. People who own shares of Apple are cheering the news that came out after the closing bell. The iPod maker and iTunes purveyor, which also makes some computers, I'm told, is reporting an 88% leap in profits. Actually, Mac shipments were way up, and Apple CEO Steve Jobs says they are, quote, clearly gaining market share. Alcoa, the world's biggest aluminum company, led the blue chips up, rising more than 5%. Internet retailer Amazon jumped nearly 27% on its blockbuster sales report. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
Here's a look at the Marketplace date book for events coming up Thursday. In Washington, President Bush hosts Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe during his first official visit to the states. The Senate Armed Services Committee examines legal issues regarding individuals detained by the Department of Defense as unlawful enemy combatants. And an opportunity to improve international relations. Tomorrow is Hog and Australian Day. Probably an occasion that not everyone can participate in, but do your best. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, as if the chairman of the Federal Reserve doesn't have enough to do, what with all that running the economy thing, now he's got a bunch of high schoolers to worry about. Ben Bernanke spent part of his day at Wilson Senior High in Washington, D.C. It's part of a campaign to teach financial literacy. The central banker told the kids they ought to learn how to handle their money, things like budgeting and using credit wisely. Commentator Ben Stein finds the choice of messenger on that subject interesting.
It is an experiment noble in purpose, and I applaud Mr. Bernanke for it. Children should know what a stock is, what a bond is, what an annuity is, what a mutual fund is, what an index fund is, and so on and so forth. But I'm not sure that financial literacy is really the name for it. Maybe it's something more like financial responsibility, or maybe even just financial gravity, as in how, as my pal Ray Lucia says, you have to make sure your assets always balance your liabilities. If you're working, you have to know that your savings in stocks, bonds, real estate, annuities are going to equal your retirement liabilities. And this is a gargantuan responsibility for most of us. You have to know that you're not going to be able to count on Social Security for much, that Medicare will probably be insolvent in 20 years or less. That means a lot of weight on your shoulders, young Americans. You have to learn to assume it, know what the yields on stocks usually are, what advantages there are to investing offshore. You have to learn what skills can't be lost to technology change or to foreign competition. You have to learn how to work hard at what counts, supporting your family by developing the human capital that pays the bills and adds to saving. These are all good lessons, but it's a tiny bit strange to have these lessons taught by the federal government, probably the most extravagant, irresponsible entity in the history of financial life. With our government's immense deficits, staggering future liabilities, largely unfunded, under Medicare and Social Security, maybe it's the kids at Wilson High School who should be teaching the government about fiscal and monetary responsibility. Somebody's got to teach them, or maybe they won't learn until the roof falls in. It's happened before to governments, and it could happen to us. Oh, well, we'll think about that tomorrow.
Ben Stein is an actor and a writer, but he's a lawyer, too, and an economist. We'd love to hear what you have to say. Tell us through our website. It's marketplace.org. Just in time for Campaign 08, political issue ads found their way to the Supreme Court today. The justices heard arguments about the particulars of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. Something called advocacy ads were in the legal crosshair, spots about political issues that also mention a specific candidate by name, which might or might not be legal under McCain-Feingold. We won't know for sure until this summer, probably, but the case is an interesting backdrop to what might wind up being the biggest issue ad of all time. Two of this country's biggest philanthropists are promising $60 million to get education reform on the political agenda. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli takes a look.
When the average Joe shows up at a presidential debate, he's lucky if he gets to ask a single question. When you're a billionaire philanthropist like Bill Gates or Eli Broad, you pull some cash and launch a major national media and advocacy campaign.
Really, the budget, as you know, is as large as that of a presidential campaign.
That's Eli Broad. He says the only way to get widespread education reform is to get everyone talking about the issue and to put presidential candidates on the spot. Education policy analyst Myron Lieberman says of the $60 million campaign,
it's a waste of money.
Lieberman says one of the Broad-Gates goals of creating a national curriculum won't ever work.
There'd be so much fighting over what agencies should do it and whether they should do it and so forth. You'll consume all your resources in the turf problem alone.
But education analyst Lisa Snell of the think tank The Reason Foundation says this isn't some random issue campaign. She says Broad and Gates have spent $2 billion on school reform, and they know what they're talking about.
They've been in the trenches doing this hardcore policy work in urban districts, and they've had significant improvement and closed the achievement gap in some places.
Snell says, sure, Gates and Broad are buying influence, but she says everyone does. Some people just have more to spend than others. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Democratic presidential wannabes will gather tomorrow night in South Carolina for their first debate of the election cycle. Their Republican counterparts will do the same next week in California. They're squeezing all the politicking in between fundraising calls. With wide-open races on both sides, the amount of money coming in is truly staggering. 18 candidates raised $130 million altogether during the first quarter. That's four times more than at the same point in the last presidential campaign. And our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports more of it's coming in smaller amounts.
Judy Crook is a part-time teacher in Rifle, Colorado. Last month, she gave $100 to the campaign of Bill Richardson. She likes his position on immigration and his international experience, and she hopes her contribution will help Richardson stay in the race.
It's really early in the campaign, but I want it to count towards something. And he actually did get some attention for having raised a lot of money, as even though he was in the second tier of candidates. And I thought, well, you know, so my little teeny tiny contribution probably helped towards that.
And in New York City, freelance audio engineer Jeff Sanoff has given $50 to John Edwards. But he's planning on giving to Senator Barack Obama as well.
What I'm looking for in a candidate is someone who's fresh, someone who's able to express the thoughts and ideas in ways that I agree with and that don't back down from having the discussion that I think we need to have as a country.
So far, Senator Hillary Clinton has the largest war chest for the coming campaign, but that's come at a price. More than half her donors have given the $2,300 contribution limit for the primaries. Senator Barack Obama has raised nearly as much money from a much broader base. Only 13% of his donors have maxed out. For John Edwards, it's 19%. Joe Trippi, who engineered Howard Dean's grassroots campaign in 2004, is now working for the Edwards campaign. He says history shows it's better to have more smaller donors than fewer bigger donors.
In the Obama campaign, for instance, if he has 90,000 people gave him $100 with a $2,300 limit, you could theoretically go back to any of those individuals 23 times. Whereas if someone gave you the maxed out check of $2,300, which happened more in the Clinton campaign than any other campaign, you can't even go back to them.
Plus, more small donors helps a candidate stay independent from outside pressure, says Sheila Krumholz, who tracks campaign contributions at the Center for Responsive Politics.
There are those among the donors that are maxing out that are expecting something in return. These are wealthy and politically astute and often very active individuals who may well be looking for a place in the new administration and perhaps are giving to multiple candidates because they want to make sure that whomever is victorious on Election Day, they've contributed to that candidate and that candidate, in effect, owes them a favor.
Small giver Jeff Sanoff sees no contradiction in donating to John Edwards and Barack Obama.
I think they both have really important things to say, and I would like to be able to, in some small way, push the conversation that the Democratic Party's having. As Hillary would say, let's let the conversation begin. I mean, I'd like it to begin by talking about things from a more populist point of view.
Sanoff says his online surfing and blog reading sparked his political interest and made it easier to contribute. American University presidential scholar James Thurber says the Internet has become a prime tool for fundraising.
It makes it very easy to contribute money and to use your credit card, and therefore you have instant money. It's not like somebody's writing a check and it takes a couple weeks to clear the check. It's instantaneous for these campaigns. It's the fuel of these campaigns these days.
Campaign officials say Internet fundraising is a lot cheaper than traditional soliciting. Just think of how much money is saved by not renting ballrooms and serving wine and rubber chicken. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, long-suffering Delta Airlines is finally emerging from bankruptcy. The nation's third largest airline spent almost 2 years restructuring, including cutting jobs and pilot pension plans. Today, a federal bankruptcy judge approved its plan to exit Chapter 11. Delta first filed for bankruptcy on September 14, 2005, crippled by high fuel prices, labor costs, and billions of dollars in lost profits. On Monday, it will be out from under court protection. And if you just can't get enough of this kind of thing, Delta will again be trading on the New York Stock Exchange come Thursday, May the 3rd. Ticker symbol, DAL. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 136 points, 1%, record high, as we've mentioned, of 13,089. The NASDAQ gained 23 points, about 1%. The S&P 500 ticked up 15 points, a hair over 1%. Our editors include John Buckley, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Stacey Vanek-Smith, and Lisa Tucker. Tomorrow on the program, what a Bulgarian singer can teach us about the global economy.
A few years ago, when the poor girl from the countryside arrived in the capital, she quickly learned you can't make a living in traditional music.
Our monthly series, Working, continues. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.